and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in ethics, metaphysics, epistemology, and many other areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Evan Thompson, Professor of Philosophy at the University of British Columbia. His new book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self and Consciousness in Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy, is just out from Columbia University Press. The quest for an explanation of consciousness is currently dominated by scientific efforts to find the neural correlates of conscious states, on the assumption that these states are dependent on the brain. A very different way of exploring consciousness is undertaken within various Indian religious traditions, in which subtle states of consciousness and transitions between such states can be revealed through meditation. In Waking, Dreaming, Being, Thompson draws on both neuroscience and these meditative traditions to illuminate consciousness and the nature of the self while avoiding both neuroreductionist and spiritualist agendas. He develops a view of our sense of self as an emergent process of eye-making that is constructed in relation to our environment and the body on which it depends. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Evan Thompson. Are you there?
I am there. Hello.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you very much.
I'm very excited to be talking about your new book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, which is a fascinating and very synthetic and sympathetically, I'd say, critical look at both neuroscience and meditative practices of Buddhism as regards to the phenomenon of consciousness and the self. And this book, in certain ways, from understanding your own background, combines a bunch of interests that you've had from what I can tell, at least not just professionally, but also personally from your upbringing. So maybe you could, to start us off, you could tell us a little bit about your upbringing and your immersion in both, I guess, Buddhist practices, as well as the cognitive and neuroscientific training that you've had and philosophical training that you've had on top of that.
Yes. So my upbringing, well, I was raised in somewhat of an unusual circumstances, I suppose. I was raised in a community in the 1970s that was also an alternative educational institute that my father, William Irwin Thompson, who's a writer, that he founded. He was a university professor in humanities at York University in the early 1970s, and he wasn't really satisfied with how the universities at that time were approaching learning, and so he quit a full tenured professorship to start an alternative institute that brought together scientists and philosophers and artists and political activists, and you could say spiritual contemplative teachers from a variety of different traditions, both Western and Asian. And in true 1970s style, it was run as a community or as a commune, you could say. So that was the context in which I grew up. So I was exposed very early to a lot of different kinds of ideas intellectually and religiously and spiritually, and in a context where all of them were very much up for, I suppose you could say, debate and critical engagement with each other. It was also a context in which the community practiced meditation together from different contemplative backgrounds. So I was raised in a context where meditation was valued, and I learned different kinds of meditation when I was very young. And it was in that setting that I was first exposed to Buddhist philosophical ideas and Indian philosophical ideas more generally. And as a result of that, partly, I decided to go when I went away to college. I went to Amherst College in 1979. And when I went away to Amherst, what I was really interested in studying was Asian philosophical tradition. So I majored in Asian studies. I studied Chinese language and Chinese history and literature mainly. I also had a strong interest in Chinese Buddhism and Taoism. And I studied Western philosophy along the way as well. And when I decided to go to graduate school, I faced a choice of, you know, whether do I go on in Asian studies? Do I go on in religion? Do I go on in philosophy? And it was really philosophy that I was mainly interested in. I was really interested in the philosophical approach to critical analysis and argumentation and ideas, but I had always been interested in it in a very cross-cultural way. So when I went into philosophy for graduate school at University of Toronto, I focused primarily in Western philosophy and very quickly got drawn into philosophy of mind and cognitive science, but I kept my interest in Asian philosophical traditions and also in Asian contemplative practices, Buddhist meditation and yoga and Tai Chi and things like that. I kept those interests all along. So it was natural for me to really always be thinking about them in some sort of inner conversation across these different traditions, even though I was really focusing on Western philosophy and cognitive science. And then in graduate school, I had the opportunity to work with someone I had met at the Lindisfarne Association. That was the name of the institute that my father founded in the 1970s. He had brought a neuroscientist named Francisco Varela to one of the conferences that he had organized. And Francisco Varela was a very pioneering neuroscientist. He was also a very serious student of Buddhist philosophy and a Buddhist practitioner. He was from Chile originally. And he became he lived with us as a scholar in residence. He became a very close family friend. He was kind of like an uncle, older brother, mentor to me. And when I was in graduate school and had started to work in cognitive science, that coincided very fortuitously with a moment when he was really interested in trying to write something together or write something about Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy and cognitive science, bringing them together from his own work. And he brought me over as a research assistant to work with him on that project because he knew that I had interest in all of these things. And out of that collaboration, eventually we wrote together our book, The Embodied Mind, mm-hmm. which was published in 1991, also with Eleanor Roche, a psychologist at Berkeley. So these things have always been kind of intermixed for me, the Asian philosophy, Western philosophy and cognitive science, collaboration with neuroscientists. I wrote my own dissertation on color vision and philosophy of perception, and Francisco Varela at that time in his lab in Paris was doing work on color vision. So I really learned from being in the lab a lot about how scientists think about questions and how they proceed to set up experiments. I had no formal scientific training because I had been trained in the humanities as an undergraduate and in graduate school. So all of the science I learned along the way collaborating with neuroscientists, especially with Varela.
Well, all of that, you know, really comes through in this book, which is also very integrative, and your comfort in these different traditions really, really does come through. So let me to get, you know, to start to get into the more of the details of the book itself. I guess there's two very broad foundational questions, you might say, that might be helpful before we get into the details. One, you know, from the scientific side, and another from the, you know, from the Buddhist side. So from the scientific side, you use the terms, you know, consciousness, experience, and awareness, right, kind of throughout the book. So, you know, at the beginning of the book, you say the central idea is that the self is an experiential process. It's enacted in processes of awareness, and it comes and goes depending on how aware we are. And a lot of the book itself, of course, talks about consciousness, different kinds of conscious states and transitions between such states. So the question on this side is just, how do you see the relationships between the phenomena that we, you know, kind of try to pick out with the terms consciousness, experience, and awareness? Because, you know, different theories of consciousness say that they are different, right? That they're different things. Some of them identify them. So I just wanted to know from that perspective, what those different, how you see those different terms related. And then from the sort of Buddhist traditional side, for people who are not so well acquainted with Buddhist traditions, if you could give those people an idea of, you know, what are the general features of that tradition that you draw on in this work?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, so if we start with the terms consciousness and awareness, experience, of course, these terms can be used in all sorts of different ways, and there's not necessarily any one right way to use them. The way that I use the terms in the book is coming from a particular model that one could describe as a pan-Indian philosophical model. That is, we find it in Buddhism, but we also find it in other Indian philosophical traditions that would disagree with Buddhism over various things, including exactly how to precisely specify these three things that I'm going to mention. But just in general terms, the model, the threefold model, would be to distinguish between awareness itself, which would be distinguished from the particular contents of awareness that would be present in any given moment. So if we're awake, the contents of awareness are largely perceptual. They're also cognitive. If we mind wander and, you know, start thinking about something, we start remembering something. If we start to fall asleep, the contents change. We experience, you know, sleep onset images. If we dream, again, the contents are different, but the phenomenon of awareness is present. So we can distinguish awareness versus whatever the object or content of awareness is in any particular moment or in any particular transitory state. And then thirdly, for whatever, let's say, arises as a content of awareness, it's either identified with as self or not identified with as self. So right now, I have an awareness of my body sitting in the chair, and I identify all of those bodily sensations as me or as mine. So there's a identification or self-identification process that's going on that marks some things off as self and other things as non-self. So in the most general terms in the book, what I tried to do is I take this threefold model of awareness, contents of awareness, and ways of identifying with certain contents as self or as I, me, mine. And I use that as a structure for looking at a whole range of different kinds of phenomena. And there again, I'm guided by another taxonomy that I think is really the oldest taxonomy of consciousness in recorded human history. And this comes from the very early Indian texts of the Upanishads, which are not Buddhist texts. These are Vedic or one could say Hindu texts. And they mark off the states of waking, dreaming, deep and dreamless sleep as distinct states with distinct phenomenal features and distinct senses of self. And then also a fourth state in some texts, which is simply identified as pure awareness. And this is very much tied to a metaphysics where awareness has its own, let's say, intrinsic nature different from any particular content that may be present, and that certain kinds of contemplative or meditative practices try to sensitize one to the nature of awareness itself, regardless of whatever happens to be occurring in awareness. So I use that taxonomy of waking, dreaming, dreamless sleep. I use pure awareness as, in a way, a kind of placeholder for different kinds of forms of awareness that might be especially occurring in various kinds of meditative practices. I use that taxonomy to organize my discussion along with this threefold model of awareness, contents of awareness, and ways of identifying with some as self. I use that as a structure for then investigating what is occurring in these states from the perspectives of neuroscience and especially the neuroscience of consciousness, also from the Indian philosophical perspectives. So sometimes that's drawing heavily on Buddhism, sometimes also on other traditions, yoga and Vedanta that are not Buddhist, those are Hindu traditions. And then also with a fair amount of, you could say, contemporary Western philosophy of mind, especially as it's been in dialogue with the neuroscience of consciousness. So that's in very general terms how the book is structured and the architecture of the book. I suppose with regard to the word consciousness, I tend to use it as a term for all three of those things together: awareness, whatever the content or object of awareness is, and whatever form of self-identification is present experientially. Consciousness marks all, or names all three of those things for me. And there I'm actually thinking in many ways of consciousness in a way that I see at any rate as rather close to how it's used in the context of Western phenomenology in the philosophical sense, coming from, say, Husserl or Brentano or Merleau-Ponty, where the intentionality or the directedness of consciousness and towards an object and an implicit self-world or self-other differentiation is present. I see that as very much that picture is very much consistent with my use of the word consciousness.
Okay, so and then the general, well, I guess maybe we can get to, you can raise particular features of the various Eastern traditions as we proceed. So let's start with waking, which is kind of where you begin examining these different different states of consciousness or different types. So what is waking and pure awareness? I mean, how do you introduce to us your discussion of mm-hmm. that particular state of consciousness from the science, from the Western and Eastern or neuroscience versus Buddhist and or Hindu perspectives?
All right. So waking is a state in which perceptual engagement with the environment is strongly present, and in which attention is typically moving from one thing to another. So, you know, in the case of, say, visual perception, we know that visual attention shifts with eye movements as you're you know, looking about at different things, either if you're, you know, sitting or if you're moving. But of course, attention also shifts to other kinds of sensory contents, to what one hears or to how one's body feels. So it's a field. It's a field of perceptual awareness with a constantly shifting attention, with a strong sense of a bodily self as the basis or anchor for the sense of self. But it's also a state in which a lot of cognitive activity is occurring. For example, you may be immersed in some engaging perceptual motor task, like typing away at the keyboard, or maybe you're cooking something at the stove, or maybe you're riding a bicycle. But you're in those contexts, your mind can also wander, and so then the sense of self shifts into things like autobiographical memory, where you identify with a certain image of yourself as represented in the past. You identify past experiences as you remember them as yours, as belonging to yourself, that feels as if it's the same self that's engaged in whatever you're doing now. So it's also a state in which there's what a lot of what psychologists would call mental time travel, autobiographical memory, projection into the future, and planning and things of that sort, but very much anchored on the reference point of the body in the environment situated perceptually. So those would be the features of waking. And so in the book, I focus a lot on perceptual experience and what neuroscience tells us about how attention functions in perception, particularly that it moves discreetly from one thing to the next, that it jumps, that it typically is in that sense unstable, moving around from one thing to another, and that can be studied in various precise ways. Especially, there's been a lot of work on that in the context of visual attention and visual perception. And I also look at it from the point of view of Buddhist philosophical theories of perception that I relate to the neuroscience findings. Maybe we might want to talk about that in a minute. That's somewhat of a separate discussion, I suppose. And issues about how one would measure awareness in a cognitive science context in the waking state in perception in relationship to things like whether one verbally reports being able to see something or whether you show some behavioral sign of the visual presence of something, but you're not actually able to report your awareness of it. So or your discrimination of it. So that raises questions about different ways of approaching the phenomenon of awareness in the context of perception. Now, you also asked me about pure awareness. Mm-hmm. Pure awareness is a concept that is used differently in the different Indian traditions. But I suppose for the moment, the idea would be that it's important to distinguish qualities that pertain to awareness itself, regardless of what state you might happen to be in, waking or dreaming, let's say, versus, again, the objects of awareness that are occurring in that state. And so certain types of meditation practices are based on the idea of, regardless, so this would be what would be described as a kind of practice of open awareness rather than a concentration practice would be one where you try to stabilize your attention on an object, say following the in and out sensations of the breath. Whereas an open awareness practice would be one where one doesn't try to attentionally select or attentionally suppress anything that occurs, simply notices whatever that arises, but in a way that where one's sensitivity, let's say, is oriented not so much to the thing that's arising, but simply to the quality of awareness itself, to the presence of a phenomenal field as such, I suppose you could say. Mm-hmm. And that would be a practice that would be orienting you towards the phenomenon of awareness, regardless of whatever content arises. Now, typically that's practiced in the waking state, of course, though this is another thing we could talk about. There are, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, practices of lucid dreaming, of when you're aware in a dream state, you would try to actually engage in the same sort of practice. So it doesn't have to just be in the waking state. So it's practiced in the waking state, and it's conceptualized as a kind of, as it were, waking up to the waking state, in the sense that ordinarily we just go about, do what we do, and our attention jumps around, we get lost in mind wandering, and we're not sensitive to simply the phenomenon of awareness itself. So becoming sensitized to that is, in a sense, you could say, a kind of waking up to the phenomenon of awareness itself.
Okay, so you mentioned lucid dreaming, and there are a couple chapters on the phenomenon of dreaming, as well as a good critical look at the phenomenon of so-called lucid dreaming, which, I mean, as I understand from what little I know about it, it has been at least somewhat controversial whether there is such a thing as lucid dreaming or whether it's really just it's not really sleeping at all. It's not where at least it does not occur in sleeping. So just to continue from the waking to the dreaming part, maybe you could say about tell us about how you analyze dreaming, consciousness in dreaming and then in lucid dreaming itself, and the different as you defend this idea of lucid dreaming in terms of different perspectives that the self can take within, dreaming.
Okay. So I distinguish, under the heading of dreaming, I distinguish three distinct phenomena, let's call them. So one is what's called the hypnagogic state. So hypnagogic literally means leading into sleep. And it's the state, the sleep onset state, where it's a kind of liminal transitional state from waking into sleep. So in this state, you close your eyes, you become relaxed, often spontaneous images will form, you'll hear sounds that you're not sure whether there really were sounds that occurred in the room, or whether they're sounds that in some sense you're imagining. So there are these let's say spontaneously generated sensory image type of contents, often there are thoughts that have a kind of meaning or coherence, but then if you were to wake up, the thought might seem strange. So there's a kind of, let's just say very generally, spontaneous mentation that's occurring. And one of the features of this state is that it's an absorbed state in which the strong, let's say, difference between a bodily self and an outer world really starts to dissolve. There's a kind of absorption in the image or in the sound. There's to use a kind of psychoanalytic language that some researchers have used, there's a kind of dissolution of ego boundaries. But unlike when you dream, there's usually not the sense of being immersed in a world. It's more, you could say, absorbed and spectator-like. It's as if, you know, the visual awareness has this kind of screen phenomenon. But there's a dissolution of this self-other structure with the absorption. So those are features that are characteristic of sleep onset. We know that certain kinds of electrophysiological brain rhythms mark this state as you go from waking into sleep. Then I distinguish that from dreaming in a more, let's say, full-blown sense, where there is a sense of immersion in a world that is in something that has spatial and temporal dimensions, and in which there is usually a strong sense of self, either in a first person perspective where you're immersed in the dream world, you're seeing the dream world through your own dream eyes, as it were. You are participating in things that are going on. So that's a kind of strong first person perspective in the dream. Or sometimes you can have a dream in which there's a more spectator quality where you see yourself from the outside as a character in the dream. We know that these two kinds of structures of, let's call it, seeing the dream from within and seeing yourself from without, that this is also the structure of autobiographical memory. So if you ask someone to recall an event from the past, they may recall it from within as if they were in some sense reliving the event, or they may see themselves from outside. And of course, presumably they didn't live the event originally from an outside perspective. So this has to do with the way that memory is consolidated and kind of cognitively restructured and very much tied to a sense of self, because you have to conceptualize yourself as a self in order to have that outside perspective. So, excuse me. So this is something that, excuse me one moment. This is something that occurs as well in the dream state. So the point here would be that dreaming has a certain sense of self that is different from the hypnagogic state. And it's an example of what I mean by identifying with certain contents as the self. Because in the dream state, everything is in some sense a creation of your mind, but you mark certain things off as you in the dream and other things as not you. Now, in the case of lucid dreaming, lucidity admits of a whole range, I suppose you could say. So it's not an all or nothing thing. It admits of degrees. The sense in which I use the term lucid dreaming is to define the state as being able to direct your attention to the dream state. So this comes in different degrees or different strengths, you could say, of lucidity. Sometimes you may have a full-blown conceptualization of yourself as dreaming, and you can think this is a dream state. And that depends, of course, on being able to direct your attention to the state as a dream state. But sometimes the directing of attention may be more implicit, let's say, and you might not be thinking explicitly this is a dream state. Now, but there's in some sense an awareness of the state as a dream and the ability to direct attention to it in that way. Now, lucid dreaming has been reported throughout human history, different cultures, coming down to us through different texts and so on. I would say that with the emergence of sleep science in the 1950s, that there was skepticism about whether there really was such a thing as a distinct state. And the thought was that, well, probably what's going on is people are waking up, They are then falling back asleep. And when they wake up again, they have a kind of retrospective confabulation of having been awake in the dream state. But really what was happening is that they had a kind of micro awakening and then went back to sleep with that memory of having been awake. And what happened is that it became possible in the development of sleep science to establish using certain kinds of physiological and behavioral measures that people can report while they're asleep, being aware that they are dreaming. And the way that they do this is by signaling awareness of the dream state through eye movements. So it's established in advance of going to sleep that if you move your eyes left and right a certain number of times while asleep, so the sense is that you're moving your dream eyes, as it were, but those dream eye movements correlate with physical movements of the eyes. And in the rapid eye movement state, regular left-right movements show up immediately as distinct from the usual darting about of the eyes. So it's agreed that the participant in the sleep lab, when he or she has the sense of being aware of dreaming, that they signal by moving their eyes in this way. And then upon awakening, the subject reports having been aware of a dream and having made those eye movements, and they're there on the eye movement trace. So using that method, it was possible to establish that there really is a very robust and reliable correlation between reports from, as it were, within sleep of being aware of being asleep and dreaming, signaling using these eye movements, and then the recording of the eye movements in the lab. And this method has now actually been used in the past 5 years to study lucid dreaming using EEG and fMRI, where you have people who are reliable lucid dreamers, and you have them fall asleep in the scanner or in the sleep lab wired up to EEG, and you have this prearranged method of signaling when they become lucid. And as a result, you can study the kinds of electrophysiological brain activities that are associated with the state in, say, EEG, or you can look at different areas of brain activation in functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what's basically seen is that electrophysiologically you see signatures, brain rhythm signatures that are indicative of aspects of consciousness and cognitive processing that are increased in that REM sleep state, the lucid REM sleep state compared to non-lucid REM sleep, that bring it in a way closer in certain respects to waking consciousness. And also in the fMRI context, you see the activation of attentional and metacognitive systems. You see them comparatively activated in the lucid REM sleep compared to non-lucid REM sleep in a way that, again, resembles the kind of activation that you would see in attentional states in the waking state. So this evidence has now basically been taken to show that lucid dreaming, you know, from the sleep science point of view, is really a distinct kind of sleep and dream state. And it's phenomenologically interesting in relationship to the sense of self, that is how we experience the self, in that in a non-lucid dream, you're immersed in the dream world and you experience that from within, perhaps from a first-person perspective, or maybe you see yourself from the outside as a figure in the dream. But when you become lucid, the sense of self shifts in the sense that you can now conceptualize yourself not just as a dream ego in the dream, but as a dreaming self. So in a very strong lucid dream, you may have the awareness that you're actually, you know, at home asleep in bed, and you can think both thoughts. I am flying in my dream, and I am asleep in bed, and I am having a flying dream. So there's an enlargement, you could say, in the structure of the sense of self that happens in the lucid dream compared to the non-lucid dream. And that's an example of a distinct self state that's part of the lucid dream consciousness.
Okay, so let me ask now. So we've got wakefulness, right? And we've got various, you know, different sorts of experiences going on within sleep. It's not just, you know, either dreaming or being awake. And then you suggest you have a very interesting perspective on the relationship between them, where you suggest that waking or wakefulness is dreaming with sensory motor constraints, whereas dreaming is perceiving without sensory motor constraints. So can you say something about the relationship between wakefulness and then the various dreaming states?
So the basic idea here is that there's always – because the brain is a complex self-organizing system with its own ongoing self-generated activity, and that this is happening all the time, that there's always spontaneous cognition and spontaneous mentation that's going on. So in the waking state, that, you know, takes the form of fantasy and daydreaming and mind wandering, and then bringing your back to what you're doing and focusing on what you're doing, and then having the mind wander again and daydream. In dreaming, the coupling of that to the perceptual environment is decreased. So of course it's still a sensory state, in that there's still all this interoceptive sensation that's coming from the body. But you are less directly engaged in the form of perception and action with the outer world than you are in the waking state. So in the dream state, that spontaneous mentation is arising in a way that's less constrained by sensory motor activity of the sort in the waking state. And I think of that as – I describe the dream state in general as a kind of state of spontaneous imagination. So I disagree with theorists who describe it as a kind of sham perceptual state or a hallucinatory state. I think of it as a imaginative state, a state of imagination or imaging. And in the waking state, that's always going on as well. There's always a generation of spontaneous imaginative activity in the form, for example, of mind wandering and daydreaming, but it's constrained, or it's in a richer dialogue with perception and action than is possible in the dream state. So the waking state, in its fullest sense, is a perceptual state that is, you could say, shaping and shaped by imagination, whereas the dream state is an imaginative state that is less directly shaped by that kind of perception.
So, I mean, this raises the question about, you know, what it's for. I mean, there is a question, what is sleep for, that sleep scientists, I don't know if they've answered it yet, but that's been a big question. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy to see from an evolutionary perspective why we would want to have the sensory motor inputs that we have when we're awake, right? Constraining our imagination. You know, that makes perfect sense. So what is dreaming for? You know, what is that unconstrained perceiving or spontaneous imagination? Why would we have that?
Well, the way that I like to look at that is not so much to suppose that dreaming has a specific, let's say, biological function. I mean, perhaps it does, and you know, we might determine that someday. But I'm inclined to think more that what's going on is, because of the kind of architecture that we have for our brain that makes mental time travel possible, where you can project yourself into the past and into the future, and that, of course, is that requires imagination, or that is a form of imagination. That because we have a brain that does this, and we have an autobiographical sense of self, that activity is always going on. And the dream state is just a particular form that it takes. So I'm inclined to think that really what needs to be determined is, you know, how is it that we come to have, as a result of the kinds of brains and bodies and social lives that we have, how is it we come to have this kind of mental time travel and sense of self? And then, given that the brain is always active cognitively, even in sleep, we know that there's learning and memory consolidation, that dreaming is just a particular form that takes. And it may have, you know, it might not be that there's anything that dreaming is for in a specific functional sense. It may just be a reflection of this way that the brain is, let's say, organized for imagination. That might be a better way to put it, is mm-hmm. I think of our brains as organized to be, you know, imaginative systems, and dreaming is just a is just a variation on that. Now, that's not to say that dreaming is just an epiphenomenal froth on the waves. It is a robust imaginative state, and as all imaginative states, you know, it's meaningful, and people can explore it for personal meaning, and it reflects their ongoing, you know, personal concerns and things of that sort. So I see it as a reflection of imaginative meaning making. That might be the best way to put it.
Okay. So let me ask about the relationship between these conscious or experiential states, whether waking or dreaming, and self, because you start the book by saying the central idea of the book is it's about the self, and the self is an experiential process, which seems to identify the self with all these various states of consciousness or experience or awareness. Could you say a little bit more about that identification,
mm-hmm.
or at least what appears to be an identification?
Yeah. So this goes back to the framework, the basic kind of organizing framework for the book, where I distinguish awareness, contents of awareness, and identification with certain contents as self, or we could just simply say awareness, contents of awareness, and the sense of self. And most of the time when I'm talking about the self in the book, I'm really talking about the sense of self, the self as experiential. And I'm talking about, you know, what in psychoanalytic terms would be called self states, states where there is some identification with something as I or me or mine that, you know, implicitly is marked off against something that isn't I or me or mine. And the main journey of the book is to look at how those self states or identification processes, how they shift across these different modes of consciousness and how they are constructed, I suppose you could say, through cognitive processes and conscious awareness. Now, at the end of the book, when I really turn to the self as a topic in its own right, there I develop an account in which the self is very much a bodily self, and that there are bodily processes of life regulation from the cellular level up through the way that the nervous system is organized that are the basis, the architectural basis, you could say, for the experiential sense of self. So in the context of that chapter, self is really referring to, you could say, things that are under constant construction in the body and mind. And I think of that, of the self, as a kind of ongoing enacted or constructive process of what I call I-making. And some of that construction is happening, let's say, psychologically or mentally, and some of it is happening biologically and physiologically, just in terms of how cells and the nervous system function.
Well, maybe we can go a little more detail into those aspects, because you mention various processes within this construction of the self, and you contrast that view, your view, even though the self is a process, it's constructed, there's various states, sometimes the boundaries of the self kind of dissolve. You take different perspectives on it, and lucid dreaming versus dreaming. But you contrast that with the idea that the self is somehow an illusion. So there's a sense of self, but that sense is not an illusion. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. So there in that chapter, I'm contrasting with my view with a view that I call neuro-nihilism. So this is the view, and in my mind, Thomas Metzinger is a principal exponent of this view. And in some ways, the view is close to mine, and in other ways, I see some real differences. So, I mean, the view basically says that the self or the sense of self is an illusion created by the brain in order to organize its own activity in certain ways. And it's an illusion because it involves projecting the sense that there is an essential, substantial I, when there is no such thing. There's just processes that make it seem as if there were such a thing. Now, there's a sense in which I agree with that. I don't think there is an essential, substantial I, that there is a self that is a distinct, that has a distinct essence, and that it's wholly present from one moment to the next in such a way that, you know, ensures personal identity. And I do think that sometimes it can feel as if there is. But I think that at a deeper level of description, what's really going on is that there's a process of construction that involves a system through its own activity specifying itself as a coherent system in relationship to the environment. And so this is what I use the term self-specifying to mean. So the simplest example of a self-specifying system is one in which you have, say, a cell that has these internal metabolic reaction networks and processes that construct it as the very thing that it is, including its membrane boundary, which in turn makes possible all of the internal constructive activity. And through that process, a kind of, you know, recursive self-organizing process, there is the emergence of a distinction between the unity that is the cell in relationship to the broader environment. So that's an example of what I mean by self-specifying in the way that, in the sense that the processes specify themselves as having a unity, not that they specify a self that's different from the system. And so what I do is I take that idea of self-specification, I describe it at that basic biological level, then I describe how the nervous system is also in perception and action organized that way, in that if, for example, you are following the path of the flight of birds across the sky, there is a process in which the nervous system marks the difference between stimulation that's caused by your eye movements versus stimulation that's caused by events in the outer world. And it marks this difference in a way that involves precisely this kind of self-specification. Certain kind of processes are marked off as self-generated and others as externally generated, so that a self-world distinction is enacted, you could say, through the architecture of the nervous system in perception and action. And none of this is illusory. It's constructed, but it's not illusory. It's functional. Then, in terms of the specific features of an experiential sense of self in a more full-blooded human sense, I talk about how there needs to be a self-designating process. So what that means is that there are experiential processes of the body and mind, and they are some of them are designated or conceptualized as self or as belonging to self. So there's, to use Buddhist philosophical language, there's a kind of basis of designation, which are the mental and bodily processes that make up a kind of causal, psychological, and physical continuum. And then there's a conceptualization of them as self. And that conceptualization is constructed, but it's functional. And it's, I think, you would say it's illusory only if you thought that what a self really truly at the end of the day had to be was a kind of substance or some inner pearl essence. And if you think that, which is kind of an extreme view, then you're going to veer to the other extreme and say, well, there is no such thing, so the self is just an illusion. But if your view was always in the middle, as it were, from the get-go, and you saw it as something emergent and constructed, then you would say that those processes create a sense of self that is very important for the kinds of, you know, lives that we lead as human beings, and it's a construction. It can come apart and be dismantled in different kinds of contexts, some of them pathological, maybe some of them beneficial in say, certain kinds of meditative experiences or flow states. That sense of self can dissolve. But that doesn't show that the self is non-existent. It shows that we need to understand it as a process rather than as a substance or as an entity.
Okay, so – but it still comes across as – let's put it more fragmentary than many people might assume or the way many of us do sense ourselves. So we have a sense of self that seems to be a lot more unitary than the picture that you seem to be describing, right? And maybe that's where the response, well, it's just an illusion, might partly come from. Do you see it as fragmentary as it seems?
I see it as constantly changing and performative. It can be fragmentary in certain contexts, or it can fragment. But I think when someone like Thomas Metzinger says, and I should say that, you know, he and I have talked about this many times, and you know, we're friends and fellow travelers in many ways, but we have different takes on this particular issue. I think he's very much in the grip of the idea that, well, it really feels experientially as if it's a substance. And my sense is, well, at a superficial level of description, we might be inclined to describe it that way, especially if we're in the grip of certain intellectual concepts, like the concept of substance, which we see in both Indian and Western philosophy. But if we really actually just, you know, think about our experience, we don't necessarily even have to meditate. We just, you know, think about, well, yes, there is definitely a strong sense of continuity in one sense between the first person experiential perspective of memory from within, such that I can remember being a kid and having certain experiences. And it seems from within to me now as if that's the same first person perspective. In another way, when I think deeply about my memories, that first person perspective is in a way a kind of formal structure, and many things about that first person perspective have changed so very much, so that there's a thread of continuity, but the continuity is also one that's constantly under transformation, and I have to, you know, enact the memory afresh in each moment. And every time I do that, of course, it changes, and I live through it in a different way. So I think that when we reflect in that way, and of course, you know, many novelists have written things like Proust, for example, that bring this out in a literary way for us to see. We can see that there is this. There is a certain kind of continuity and stability, say, to memory, but there's a lot of performance, transformation, and construction at the same time.
So what is the unity or continuity rooted in? I mean, what gives you that?
Oh, I would say that there's a continuity that's psychological and that's also causal. There's, you know, bodily, physiological, neural continuity, mm-hmm. though that can also get disrupted, of course, as we know. And there's the kind of psychological continuity of that sense from within of, a persisting first-person perspective. But at the limit of analysis, that becomes, as I was saying, kind of a formal structure because everything in it, you know, changes so much.
Okay, so, mentioning the neural basis, unlike the pan-Indian traditions that you also draw on in the book, you do argue that against some form of dualism, where the self and consciousness are dependent on the body, or I should say actually body, because you don't think it's just the brain. Mm. Can you say a bit about your view? It's an emergentist view, I take it, of the relationship between the self and consciousness and the neural basis.
Mm-hmm. So there's a number of things to say there. So in terms of the views at a certain point in the book, mainly chapter 3, that I bring into kind of critical engagement with each other. One is a particular Buddhist view that is a dualist view. It's a mind-body dualism, derives in its most, I suppose, kind of rigorous philosophical articulation from the Indian Buddhist philosopher Dharmakirti. it's very much the view that informs the education of the Dalai Lama and the perspective from which he tends to speak when he's engaging with Western science and philosophy of mind. And it's a mind-body dualism, but it's not a substance dualism. It's an event or process dualism. So there are mental events that have their own distinct nature and physical events that have their distinct nature. And physical events are not sufficient to generate or produce mental events, but they can enter into mutually conditioning relationships. Now, in the book, I criticize that view, and I argue that conceptually and empirically, there's very good reason to think that consciousness does not have that distinct self-standing nature, and that it's contingent and dependent on embodiment, let's say, to put it in the most general way. And that goes along with me for emergentism in the sense that I think that the increasing cognitive complexity of consciousness that we see, say, in evolution and phylogeny and biological life is dependent on the increasing complexity of the organism and the nervous system. So I'm an emergentist in that sense. But I'm not a reductive physicalist in the sense that I think that to really understand how consciousness is a natural phenomenon in a way that would definitely rule out certain versions of Buddhism, that we would really need to reconceptualize our understanding of what it is for a process to be a natural one or what it is for something to be physical, because the way that we conceptualize the physical is such that it by definition excludes the mental. To say something is fundamentally physical is at the most, you know, basic level of reduction is supposed to imply that it's not mental. Mm-hmm. And if something is essentially subjective or mental in the sense of having some subjective or phenomenal character, that's not supposed to conceptually entail anything about the physical. So I think that as long as we're operating with those kinds of concepts, there's always going to be a conceptual explanatory gap, and that bridging or overcoming that gap would really require a revision of our concept of the physical or the natural so that it doesn't exclude the mental. So in that sense, actually, what I try to put together is a kind of emergentist position with what you might call a kind of neutral monism, the right. idea that the mental and the physical are not the fundamental categories. They're aspects of something that is deeper than that conceptualization. I'm very attracted to that idea, not necessarily the specific features of any one neutral monist in Western philosophy, but the general shape of that idea is something that I find very attractive. So I see that as not emergentism in the usual physicalist sense, though I think it's compatible with the kind of emergentism that I was just speaking about.
Okay, so I think I have time for maybe one more question. And so there was something interesting that you note at the, you know, towards the very end of the book, I think in the last chapter, about wandering minds. You mentioned it here earlier. But one of the things that really struck me was the idea of a wandering mind as an unhappy mind, mm-hmm. Which, you know, phenomenologically, that does seem to be true. At least sometimes. But I was just wondering if you might say a little bit more on why mind wandering would have such a negative valence. I mean, a bit of a speculative question, but right. it is kind of interesting to wonder why.
Yeah, so I'm actually quoting a study that was done at Harvard by Dan Gilbert and others. If I were writing that chapter today, I would actually back off of endorsing that study in quite the way that I appear to do, in the sense that mind wandering can certainly be associated with negative affect. There are psychological studies that show this, often because when we mind wander, we ruminate and we get drawn to concerns that you know, that are indicative of, you know, things that were that are problems in our lives or that we're unhappy about. So and the, you know, the sort of extreme of that is depressive rumination. So that can certainly happen. But we also know that mind wandering is associated with creativity, facilitates creativity, it facilitates insight. So I wouldn't want to overstate the association between mind wandering and unhappiness. It's really, I would say, it's getting stuck in rumination or attached to valenced images of self that make us unhappy. Because mind wandering is typically, you know, when you mind wander, you think about yourself, you project yourself back into the past or into the future, and that can be very negatively valenced, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Okay. Well, let me just, before we end, I wanted to ask about what your next project will be. Are you continuing some of the work that you've started in this book, or are you turning to something else?
I am a little bit in between things, but I'm drawn towards the idea of working on the basis of the chapter on dying and death in Waking Dreaming Being, and elaborating or developing some of the ideas that are sketched in that chapter in a way that really deals or encounters the philosophy of death in a much more sustained, substantive way. And what attracts me there is the idea of recovering something in philosophy that, you know, that was very present in philosophy in the ancient world, which was the idea that philosophy was a preparation for dying, and was a practice that would give one the tools, you could say, for understanding one's nature as a mortal being, and that one will eventually face death, and that, you know, all of us will face that. And that was very present in ancient philosophy in India and in Greece and in Rome and in China. And modern philosophy, I think, has lost that sensibility. We've gained a tremendous amount of depth and development in philosophy, often that goes along with a technical expertise in analysis, whether in logic or philosophy of language or metaphysics. And I think that's all to the good. But I would like to recover this philosophical sensibility that's really oriented towards a meditation on dying and death. And this is, of course, very central to contemplative practices, to meditation and the contemplative way of life in the Indian traditions, and also of course in the West, in the form of what Pierre Hadot calls spiritual exercises. So this is something that I'm thinking about. I haven't yet really pursued it in a way where it's taken form in writing or structure yet, but it's a direction I think I'm inclined to go in.
Great. So, well, I look forward to reading that work. But for now, I think we have run out of time. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Evan Thompson, professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia. We've been talking about his new book, Waking Dreaming Being, Self and Consciousness in Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.